Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm David Santo, your host, and today we're looking at and thinking about and talking fat, both eating it and being it, and some of the ways in which fat and fatness have complex effects on our psyches, our well-being, and our societies in general. But before we dive into this delicious subject, here are a couple of soundscapes to immerse yourself in. That first one was a symphony of insects in a forest, doing their noisy best to create a cacophony of communication and contrasting calls. Insects, as we know, are all around us in our buildings, in our cities, in the woods and wetlands, and in the air and under the soil. There are about 1 million species of insects known to humans, but some scientific estimates suggest that there are as many as 10 million insect species on Earth. We just don't know about them all. What's more, for every living human on the planet, there are more than 1 billion insects for each of us, each one of us. For the most part, though, we rarely see that volume of life. And when we do cross paths with one or a few of them inside our homes, it can feel surprising and sometimes very disruptive. But instead of acknowledging them and even welcoming their presence in our living spaces, we try to invisibilize them, both literally and figuratively, try to make them just kind of go away. For those of us who live in less urban environments, though, insects are very much more visible, and so are their central roles in food webs and other fundamental ecological processes. Pollinators, for example, are completely critical to the production of food, even though many human activities are making it harder and harder for pollinators to do their thing. The second sound was one I recorded one spring night near where my parents used to live on the west coast of Canada. A road from their house to the small cottage I was staying in passes next to a marshland, one that looks kind of unremarkable at first glance, but which has enormous amounts of life within and around it. That particular night was one in which the marsh was full of spring peepers, those little baby frogs, and they were being just fabulously operatic. Their collective singing was, well, maybe not quite deafening, but it was certainly very loud. And the moon was shining, it was gorgeous out, but at 10 o'clock at night, I couldn't see a single peeper. I could only hear that amazing chorus. Insects and frogs are both vital parts of our ecosystems, and they exist in huge numbers. But because they're either small or hidden from sight a lot of the time, we have an easy time ignoring them and forgetting about the complex cycles of life that they enable. Then when they do pop into our sight lines, we're surprised or disgusted sometimes, reactive in good and bad ways, and also maybe delighted and charmed. We're just very visual, we human beings. In a similar way, I think fat has been made both too invisible and too visible. Fat in our food is everywhere. It's in almost all stuff that we eat, both in its whole state and also very much so in the more manufactured products that we buy. It's also extracted from a lot of different processed foods and sometimes replaced with other more synthetic ingredients in order to create a kind of appealing mouthfeel or texture or taste. There's a disturbing amount of energy, though, that's put into invisibilizing fat, both by consumers and by corporations. And at the same time, way too much attention is also paid to fat when it's seen on human bodies. Fatness is demonized and shamed, becoming a subject of derision or cruel humor, moralistic criticism. From family members to our medical authorities to clickbaity gossip magazines, fatness is used as a way to characterize certain people and certain foods as bad. But it's not always been that way, and indeed, in history, fatness was often respected and highly desired. So the unresolved tension between the visibility and invisibility of fat and fatness is what I'm going to try to focus on in this episode. That tension just isn't doing us eaters any good. In any case, however we've arrived at these societal conceptions of fat, it's time to stop using them as a point of difference and demonization, and it's time to find a more equitable and enjoyable relationship to all things fatty. Hopefully, some of what our three guests have to say on the matter will help with that process. My conversations today include ideas about fat phobia, fat activism, the medicalization of fat bodies, and the celebration of eating different kinds of fat. Maxime and I experienced some pretty amazing mouthfuls of fat during the stick this in your mouth segment, and we both rejoice in the fact that both of us have recovered from the times when we thought we needed to be on a diet. And at the end of this episode, our first scientist, a physicist from Kingston, Ontario, will respond to the Making a Meal of It food questionnaire. First up, Dr. Jennifer Brady, a professor of nutrition and dietetics at Acadia University in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. Jennifer's research focuses on the ways in which science and society come together to produce various effects in and on our bodies. She has written and edited many scholarly articles and books on the subject, including Conversations in Food Studies and Feminist Food Studies. And she makes a pretty mean tuna salad sandwich. I'm really excited to talk to you today about your work, particularly because you focus on these two areas or this subject called critical dietetics and critical nutrition studies. Okay. And I think for a lot of people, that's a mouthful. Tell me a bit about it and what do those two terms mean and why are they important?
Yeah. So, I mean, critical dietetics and critical nutrition studies are a part of my work. And for me, they kind of fit under a broader umbrella that I typically describe as exploring food, health, and social justice, the ways of knowing, by which I mean sort of science, the, you know, sort of focus on science as a way of knowing in understanding nutrition, as opposed to, say, you know, pleasure.
So it's sort of the ways that we measure food in many ways, and the way that we measure it, particularly as regards to when it goes into a human body.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that we sort of assign values to foods based on the numbers that we can kind of extract or create around them. So calories, for example, you know, high calorie foods, we assign certain sort of values to those foods. And, you know, on one level, we talk about foods as being, you know, maybe less healthy because they're higher in calories, and those foods that are low in calories as being healthy. That's not just about health, and that's not just about physiological health. There's a lot of values that go along with how we think about health. Health isn't just this sort of thing we understand through science, and it's just all our biology. There's a lot of values, cultural, social, economic, political values that inform how we understand health. And nutrition, insofar as it's a part of that, is one window into exploring how that works.
So the critical part is actually about adding that social values, that cultural values, interpreting the numbers within a bigger context. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, how I describe the critical part of critical dietetics or critical nutrition studies is specifically looking at power. And even more specifically, inequities in power, the way that power is distributed in unequal or inequitable ways.
And so the power that you're talking about is the power that exists within, say, the idea of science and the people who use science, scientists, or nutritionists, or even government authorities who have a kind of authority to dictate certain ways of being with our food, certain things to eat, certain ways to eat, certain values that are ascribed to what we eat. And those powers are often, they're intended to be used for good, but they often have negative effects on individual eaters, right?
Absolutely. I mean, science, I think, you know, we get taught in right from elementary school, right through high school, that it's possible to create knowledge using the tools of science in a value-free, objective way, so that the knowledge that gets created is just capital T truth, that doesn't have the, you know, fingerprint of human beings on it, whether that knowledge is, like you said, being sort of promoted by government bodies, like, let's say, you know, public health or Health Canada, or by the wellness industry, you know, the sort of the diet and wellness industry do the same thing. What's interesting is they often promote very different values, but they sort of coexist as these two main ways of understanding food and nutrition.
Yeah, sure. And it's not to say that the science is bad or does something bad for humans. It's very, very useful and we need scientists of all varieties. But the ways that that information then gets used in society often has these sort of troubling effects on people's bodies and makes us feel bad or makes us focus on the things that aren't necessarily producing health and wellness, but maybe producing profit for example, a diet industry.
Oh, absolutely. But also, you know, I think a lot of people, when you say diet industry, they'll say, oh yeah, that's bad. Diet industry is bad. It's just all about profit making. But, you know, the sort of healthy, so-called healthy foods have industries built up around those as well. Even research, you know, the scientific research that goes into sort of deciding, making these sort of decisions about what is healthy, what's not healthy, also has an industry built up around it. So none of the activity that goes on within dietetics or nutrition can claim being neutral, not in some way self-interested.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then a lot of the messages that come out of not just the academic study of food, but then all those institutions that you mentioned, including from corporations and government and wellness industries and all these other bodies that wield the power to communicate about food, they produce a lot of different, sometimes conflicting messages, but a lot of them are very much about demonizing fat, demonizing high calories, demonizing sugar, processed foods, making negative, and not just eating fat, but also being fat. And a lot of us feel that way because we've been swimming around in this soup of messages that are coming at us from all corners. So what is that doing to us as individual eaters and as a larger society?
Oh my gosh, I think it's doing so much. I could boil it down maybe by saying, you know, I think it is ruining our relationship and enjoyment of food and eating and all that that brings into our lives, relationships, culture, spirituality. You know, it distances us from those things when it makes us fearful of the vehicle through which we connect with those things, which is food. Food is at the center of so much of what we do on a daily basis, you know, the three meals a day or whatever eating pattern you have. So there's the, you know, feeding yourself each day. But, you know, if you think about birthday parties, funerals, births, marriages, graduations, any sort of spiritual or cultural events through the calendar year, food is at the center of all of those things. And so if we have this fearful relationship with food, I think it then distances us from those other things that food is such a big part of. Hmm. So I think we just sort of end up living in this really disconnected way, this really fearful way. It also disconnects us from pleasure. Pleasure is one of the sort of sacrificial lambs of all the health talk. You know, that to me, I think is the most negative, detrimental thing, that we become fearful of pleasure and fearful of our bodies in that as well, because your body is the only way, is the vehicle for experiencing pleasure. So this sort of fear we have around fat, I think at the crux of that is this, what it does to us is it creates this fear of our bodies, that our bodies are constantly at risk of getting fat. So we have this need or this drive to control our bodies because there are these sort of bad things that are out of control and do things that they're not supposed to be doing. So we need to clamp down on that.
And that kind of clamping down or fear is what's at the root of what we call fat phobia. That is the sort of not just fear of the fat body, but also distaste for and rejection of and anger towards and all sorts of things. Can you talk to me a bit more about fat phobia and also the reaction or the context in which fat phobia sits, which is what we call fat politics?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's more than just a fear of fatness. I think there is a drive really to eradicate fat people. When you think about the lengths that we're going to, and they just seem to get more and more intense. You know, we have surgical methods of making fat people thin, you know, and we used to have surgical methods of dealing with a whole bunch of types of people that we saw as problematic, you know, women, LGBT folks, you know, gay folks used to be lobotomized. You know, it was a medical diagnosis that was then medically treated. And I think it's very much similar to the way that we see fatness now. We've highly medicalized it. It's now a sort of seen as a disease. Obesity is now seen as a disease. And we treat it medically and surgically with bariatric surgery, despite the mountains of evidence that we have showing all of the negative effects of bariatric surgery. It's not just a fear. It's this drive to eradicate fat people.
I mean, I know it's impossible to pinpoint a reason or a time when that drive to eradicate fat people might have started emerging. But historically, fat people have been venerated throughout history in many ways, or at least admired, because it was a demonstration of their ability to feed themselves, a demonstration of wealth. So fatness in all sorts of time periods across the planet has been admired and respected and considered good. I know that there are certain terms within this dialogue, particularly the word obesity, that you are really not a fan of. There's a lot of language around obesity that makes it into a medicalization of fatness. Why is that problematic?
So a lot of reasons. I mean, first I'll maybe just speak to why the word obesity is problematic. The root meaning of obesity is it essentially means to eat until one's fat. And that's not how fatness even works. Even within that understanding that's represented by that word obesity is very much an individual, you know, individual blame, that an individual person has made bad choices and they've eaten themselves into this state of being this unsightly example of their gluttony. So from a physiological perspective, I mean, fatness, we know from research, is up to 80% genetic, just like height. You know, we don't have this pandemic of heightness, you know, even though people are getting taller. But we don't panic about that. But back to the obesity. So I think, although, you know, more recently, now that it's been rebranded, this obesity has been rebranded as a disease, I think that creates a much more slippery problem. And the reason is because the rebranding was meant to take the blame off the individual person.
So in some ways, this attempt to turn obesity into a disease, or what you call the rebranding of obesity, and the attempt to make it not the fault of the individual who is in that condition or has that body shape, the reverse has sort of happened. And by making a disease, it's a problem to be solved, or a thing to be corrected or fixed. So instead of being a fat person, you're now a problem, or you're now an issue that needs to be changed because you are not right, because you have a disease.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, well, we don't blame the victim, but we still hold them responsible. You know, we still expect them to take these medications or to submit to bariatric surgery or, you know, lap banding, or to at least sort of almost kowtow to this idea that they do need to be fixed, that there is something wrong with them.
So in addition to starting to re-understand obesity, same thing with body mass index or BMI. This is a scientific way of understanding how much fat a body carries, but it's also based on perhaps some kind of problematic ways of measuring bodies too. So both BMI and obesity are starting to be talked about in a few circles with a more critical perspective, and perhaps understanding that they're not necessarily the best ways of either measuring or describing bodies, whether fat or thin.
The main change that I'm seeing is seeing BMI as one of several points, sort of data points that we might need to assess someone's health. So BMI, rather than being what it used to be treated as a sort of definitive categorization, I'm seeing it now be more, okay, well, yes, we still have to consider BMI, but we have to consider these other factors as well. You know, what the person eats, their exercise, and other sort of lifestyle factors. Where BMI came from, though, I think is an important thing to understand in answering that question. So I think most people don't know that BMI was created in the 1800s by insurance companies and primarily used white men in France in the 1800s. Well, none of those people exist anymore. So we're using this very narrowly created, very narrowly defined way of understanding health through weight, based on a very small group of, you know, human existence. So we know BMI is particularly ineffective for racialized folks because of the different body shapes and sizes that go along with different populations. But BMI, just from a mathematical and physiological perspective, doesn't make sense. How you calculate that is someone's kilograms divided by meters squared. So you take their height in meters, times it by itself, and then kilograms is divided by that number. There's no medical basis for kilograms over meters squared to be the defining factor of how healthy we are.
as you're saying this, I'm starting to think human bodies are being treated like test tubes on a rack rather than complex food systems. And each of us is a complex food system in addition to living within complex food systems. So trying to get to a more complex understanding of how to not just measure, but understand our health and well-being beyond BMI, beyond calories, beyond pounds and kilograms is probably where we really need to go.
Absolutely. And, you know, just going back to food, nutrition's a long game. What you put in your mouth today really doesn't make any difference to your overall health or nutrition. It's a practice of taking care of your body over weeks, months, and years.
Yeah, it's not simple. And it's not obvious. This is a very complex subject. I'm so glad that we could have a chance to unpack some of these questions together.
Yes.
You are a wonderful voice, a wonderful advocate and ally and an educator. And I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, I get into the politics and poetics of fat activism with the amazing and inspiring Virgie Tovar. For more than a decade, Virgie has been non-judgmentally teaching people about the harmful effects of weight-based discrimination and the benefits of celebrating body diversity. She's a writer, podcaster, Instagrammer, and public speaker, and she has a master's degree in sexuality studies with a focus on the intersections of body size, race, and gender. Well, Virgie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It is an absolute delight to be in your virtual presence.
Be here. Thank you for having me.
Let me dive into a question that everyone by now should already understand what these concepts of fat phobia and fat activism are, but I don't think everybody does know. Could you just explain briefly to our listeners what that's all about?
Yeah, I mean, some people use the word fat phobia. Some people use the word anti-fat bias. It's also interchangeable with phrases like weight discrimination. Mm-hmm. I think they kind of all mean slightly different things. Like, you know, for example, the bias is the attitude, kind of like what's in our brain. And the discrimination is kind of the lived reality of how those attitudes impact whether or not someone can navigate society meaningfully. But fat phobia / anti-fat bias is really a set of attitudes that are about like negative attitudes towards people in larger bodies. And those attitudes are often obscured through the language of health or beauty or morality. But when you kind of look at the reality of how this type of discrimination or bias impacts people in larger bodies, it becomes really, really clear that it's a form of discrimination. And this includes things like there's a pretty large wage gap between plus size women and straight size women. If you are in a larger body, you are less likely to receive preventive care at the doctor. There's obviously like romantic discrimination, even friendship discrimination. Employers and doctors have been very overt and upfront with researchers who are trying to measure bias that they outright prefer not to hire or to have patients who are in larger bodies where they think worse of these candidates or patients, you know, and these have really big material consequences, obviously, not just money, but also quality of life and ongoing stress from anticipating and experiencing these kind of negative attitudes. And then fat activism is sort of an umbrella of different types of interventions or solutions to this. It really is just a form of activism that is invested in both changing legislation so that weight discrimination, which is currently legal, I mean, I live in the US, but it's currently legal in 48 out of 50 states. So, you know, creating legislation that protects larger body people from this and that normalizes body diversity and says that, you know, yes, larger bodied people are not like necessarily ill, right? In the same way that, you know, not all thin people are healthy, not all fat people are ill. And so I think kind of like there's this just work in trying to help people understand within fat activism, what is fat phobia? How does it impact people? How do we normalize body diversity? How do we celebrate larger bodies even? The research on weight is actually really clear. Like for the most part, you cannot control your weight long term. The science is really, really clear. The ways in which doctors, in particular, and health professionals promote weight loss. Can you imagine any other health, like alleged health intervention that has a 90% plus failure rate that is being given out day in and day out. It's kind of unthinkable. And yet that's kind of the reality that we're in.
You mentioned this expression to me and I didn't understand it, so I want to understand it. Tell me about how food can be used as a political aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a fancy way of saying, you know, in the same way that we use fashion to tell a story about who we are and maybe what we value, you know, food is also part of that story. I think of food as an extension. I mean, food is so many things, right? It's like comfort and memory and it's like nutrition and it's delicious. It's like all of these incredible things, but it is also a symbol in our culture. Sort of foods like hot dogs and pizza and hamburgers are used as almost stand-ins for fat people, and the ways that vegetables, lettuce, things like that are stand-ins for thin people. And sort of there's this idea about how fat people eat. For long stretches of time in my life, I was completely 100% committed to becoming thin and losing weight and becoming like this idea of quote unquote healthy, quote unquote beautiful. And so I was living that life and I was monitoring everything I ate and, you know, obsessive exercising and all of this stuff. And because I was told that was what I was supposed to do and that, you know, ultimately that effort would be rewarded with a thin body, which ultimately would be a body that was not going to be abused. You know, that was not going to be targeted for fat phobia. And that was kind of the goal. I mean, right. Because I think when you're experiencing something like fat phobia or any kind of oppression, you kind of eat the shame. And I think that when you realize that it's wrong and that you didn't deserve it, that shame turns into what its actual form is, which is anger. And then you want to kind of express it. I think for me, the anger and the channeling became about the public display of no longer being that good fat girl who's supposed to be losing weight on a diet all the time. And so that was how food went from a political symbol of my shame to a political sort of aesthetic of my pride. And I started to find myself like not only eating, like not only kind of wanting to be associated with a variety of foods, but in particular wanting to use foods that I quote unquote am not supposed to eat as a fat woman. I was really drawn to those as like strong political statements. And so for me, it was like not like wearing clothes that had pizza on it or hamburgers or hot dogs, you know, taking photos. And for me, obviously the internet and selfies and Instagram, it took like, you know, historically fat people have not had the sort of means of production, right? We have been produced through the fatphobic lens and we have not been the ones creating the story. And so with Instagram, we could tell our own stories for the first time. And I just found myself really wanting to be associated with this like image of someone who is breaking the rules. And I kind of want to say like, it was about anger and provocation. Of course, it was also about play. And I think specifically, it was about my humanity. And so for me, the kind of reclamation of those foods, not only as foods I ate, but as symbols and visual signals of sort of where I was at, it was about sort of clapping back at this idea that fat people aren't fully human. And that part of that is this limited intake, this limited slice of life that we're allowed to experience.
Various members of the queer community have taken back language in a lot of different ways. Yes. To re-own the tools of oppression and wield them oneself as a kind of, you know, maybe not a visual aesthetic, but certainly a verbal or a sensorial aesthetic. These are my words. These are my language, and I'm allowed to use them. I'm allowed to walk down whatever aisle, whether it's a grocery store aisle or a fashion boutique aisle or a political aisle, and say, here I am. And you have to deal with me and I have to deal with me and we're going to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think like specifically with the queer example, it's like the history of that activism is extremely queer. So a lot of this aesthetic was developed first by queer women and then was sort of became like the fat politic became layered onto the gender politic and like the sort of the queer politic.
Fingers crossed. We'll see what happens. You're also working on and writing about this concept that you've named junk food liminality and how junk food gets pushed out because it is considered, in big air quotes, bad, as opposed to the good food like celery and lettuce. Am I getting it sort of right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, what I found really fascinating, sort of like there, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about, again, queer theorists who really talk about the ways in which queerness and transness push against kind of the edges of the rules. And the reason why people get so upset about the rule breaking is because of this idea that societies are at their most vulnerable at the edges. And I think it's definitely queer theorists, and I think critical race theorists who have talked about this, like, concept of liminality and borders and like that sort of thing. And so what I find really interesting as someone who thinks a lot about food and writes about food, I mean, body is so important to me, but what I came to realize was that the way people talk about food is how they talk about bodies. The way they talk about bodies, how they talk about food. They're often an interchangeable lexicon, which is actually, when you sit back and think about it, is very weird, actually. But anyway, to talk about the junk food liminality, we have to take a sidestep adventure journey to the concept of healthism, which, like, in the US is particularly strong. And the healthism is the idea that your health is your private property, that, you know, how long you live or how well you live is firmly in your hands. Now, again, going back to data doesn't support this. You know, for the most part, the data is very clear that the social determinants of health, so things that you can't control, are the biggest indicators of the quality and length of your life. And you ask any healthcare company, they all know this research, right? And yet that's not how we don't live in alignment with that data. So healthism is very, very strong in the United States. And I mean, I think what I find fascinating is people are so preoccupied with how people eat as a proxy for their health and their weight in a culture that is so staunchly obsessed with individualism. That's kind of the side journey. But to go back, what I found very fascinating was that people will get extremely heated about food. And so I found myself sort of really contemplating, like, what is that about? And that's kind of where the junk food liminality came in. And actually, the whole idea of this came up when I was having, like, I don't even know what it was. It was one of those, like, internet food innovations, like the Korean corn dog. Like, it's like, I don't even know. Like, it pushes the limits of, like, oh my God, this feels so good to chew. It tastes so good. It smells so good. It looks so good. And it's like, I was having, like, literally this kind of, like, sensory overload from one of these food trends. And I was like, oh, this is the terror that is, like, our Protestant roots. I mean, because the history of food in the US is very connected to the history of religion and sexuality.
Sure. And morality, deeply connected to morality. And what you've mentioned, the sort of idea that we're in control of what we eat, which is also completely not true, given that the food systems are so incredibly complex and tightly bound to other systems, that there's really, we have choice, but we don't really have freedom. Anyway, back to the junk food liminality, sorry.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about it and how I was like, oh, right, like this sensory overload, this sense that, like, a Korean corn dog, let's just say, because I love Korean corn dogs, it's like, if a Korean corn dog can, like, blow my mind, right, push my senses to the limits, I remember feeling so embodied in that moment, because that's the thing about the senses, right, when they're activated, you are embodied. That is literally the practice of embodiment, and our culture is not about the practice of embodiment. It doesn't support that process, right? We're supposed to be intellectual creatures. And I think that same history that makes somebody get so up in arms about pizza and hot dogs or whatever, that same history is like living in that kind of terror of this particular kind of food. Because again, it pushes us to this limit. And I think it's like the sensory corporeal limit of what the senses can experience, but also like this kind of moral limit insofar as food becomes a stand-in for our own morality.
But and you're not allowed to eat all the things you've just described and also be a good person. That those two things just don't align. If you eat in quotes, bad food, then you are a bad person. It comes back to what you were saying about this conflation of the human and the food, and yes, that we are the same as our food, which is not true. We are made of the food that we eat, of course, but we're also made of all the symbolic elements of the food we eat. And we really shouldn't be dumping a lot of negative symbolism on top of this delicious stuff, especially things like Korean corn dogs. I've never had one. I'm dying to have one now.
Oh my gosh, you have to have one. And I mean, like, at the end of the day, it's like everyone has eaten a hot dog. Everyone has eaten a salad. Like, this is like, there is, I think there is like more universal reality than we care to think about or contemplate, you know?
Yeah. As individuals, I know I've got my own internalized fat phobia against myself and against other people. And it's not something I'm ever proud of, and I work against it, but it's there. It's part of the way I've grown up and I've been socialized, and I don't know how to get rid of it. And I know it's a continuing process, but can you advise me, can you advise our listeners on how people can move through these ingrained social patterns that we've grown up with, that we've come to think are normal, even though they're not?
Yeah, I mean, I always advise people to be really patient and compassionate and to not lose time to shame spiraling over a thought. You know, it doesn't have to be this kind of self-flagellating work. And I really encourage people to kind of think of it actually in terms of the healing, right? Like, there are things that you can do behaviorally that are very simple, like just not talking about your body or other people's bodies, just not talking about how you eat or other people eat. Like, that's one thing that is so easy and that would totally change the culture overnight, you know? In terms of the healing, I think we're really talking about recognizing that fat phobia, whether you experience it overtly or not, is a form of trauma. It's a form of social trauma. You know, we're all born these children who kind of have this like limitless potential to connect and have intimacy and feel close to others. And children want to feel that with animals and trees and people. And then we have a society that starts to cut off more and more of those people. Oh, these people are bad, so you can't be close to them. These people aren't good, so you can't be close to them. And really thinking about it from the perspective of a child, that information and that process of education is extremely traumatizing. It's traumatizing to experience fat phobia. It's traumatizing to witness fat phobia. And we're all in one of those boats, if not both. And so I think, like, when you think about the reaction you're having when you see kind of a fat body or your own body, or you see fat on your body, remember that child who's being told that that's bad. And that's what's happening. That's what's happening over and over and over and over again, is you're reliving that moment when someone said, if you have that, you will not be loved. If you have that, you will be isolated from people. But I mean, I just think, right, like, what would it look like to say, this thought might always pop up for my entire life, and I can always act on my values, not on what the voice is telling me to do, you know? And I think that that's kind of like, that's what the real work of healing is.
Yeah. Yeah. Virgie, I can't thank you enough. This has been, I would talk to you for an hour and a half more, but unfortunately we've got to move on, and you've probably got to move on and do one of your 25 different projects, but I'm really grateful to you and to all this time and all this great insight. I hope you have a fabulous day, and next time on the West Coast, I'm going to get myself a Korean corn dog.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Thank you for having me.
For more about the ways in which Virgie both leads and instigates change, from her articles in Forbes magazine to her TEDx talk, her books, and her media coverage, check out our show notes and Virgie's own website at virgietovar.com. My third guest on the show is Deb Olenek, a naturopathic health and wellness consultant with a wide range of life experience and a lot of professional and academic training. Deb has a doctorate in naturopathic medicine from Bastyr University and a master's in food culture and communication from the University of Gastronomic Sciences, which is where she and I first met many years ago. Well, Deb, it's so good to see you and talk to you. Thank you so much for joining me on this podcast.
You're welcome. It's good to see you, David.
It's a real pleasure after so many years. And we did meet many, many years ago, way back then in Italy, when you came to the University of Gastronomic Sciences to do your master degree there. What were you doing before that? I don't think I ever asked you. And what prompted the adventure to go to Italy to study food?
Well, I'm a naturopathic physician. So I was practicing naturopathic medicine in Great Falls, Montana. I had been practicing about 10 years and was getting a little frustrated with the challenges, the what we call the obstacles to cure for people. That's a term we use to talk about things that get in the way of people finding their way to health. So still love my profession, but really started focusing more on a passion for food and food, the challenges about food quality and food access. And why is it so hard for our society to develop and implement healthier models that are currently in existence? So I went on a journey. I found University of Gastronomic Sciences, and they had a program that interested me. And I thought, well, this is a good place to start getting a big picture, the global view of food systems and how it all works.
And that led you into this much larger, or much, not larger, but much more expanded world of food systems and food studies and gastronomy and all the stuff that, that is food.
Yeah, and health. And it was really, was my patients and seeing their challenges. People in general know what they need to do to be healthy, but our society makes it so challenging to access what we need for good health. And we live in a stressful society. We've got to get things done, and food does not become, it's not a big enough priority because there's just easier ways to go.
So it is very much a systemic problem, as you described. So once you finished up with a degree in Italy, we sort of lost touch for a while. But what have you been doing since then?
Well, I guess you could say I've been seeking, traveling, learning. I still do health consulting, but my desire to continue learning about food is still strong. I studied urban agriculture. I did a 6-month apprenticeship in organic farming. I consulted on an urban agriculture project in Flint, Michigan.
Incredible. Well, so one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you was because 10 years ago, when you defended your master thesis at that university in Italy, and this has stuck in my mind ever since, you were doing research on pork fat, including the health benefits of pork fat relative to the consumption of other kinds of fat, both animal and vegetable. And I just found it, I mean, from my naive perspective, I thought a naturopathic doctor is doing research on the benefits of pork fat. That seems sort of two things that don't go together, but you made so much sense and the work was so well developed and very compelling. And I certainly learned a lot about that. But what did you learn in the process of doing that research? What surprised you?
One of the main things is the composition of pork fat that I kind of drilled down on to see, well, you know, where does it stand in all of that? Saturated fats have been dubbed bad for our health, and that's a whole nother story. But really what I learned is that pig fat is not all saturated fat. And, you know, here I am, a health professional, and food is the main component of in my work helping people be healthy. But I still really didn't ever drill down on what exactly was in pig fat. But anyways, it's a mix, and it's actually more balanced in the types of fats it has to offer than even butter and some of our vegetable oils. So there's saturated fats, but then there are also mono and polyunsaturated fats, which have a better health profile for us. And pig fat is actually more monounsaturated fat than saturated fat. And it's, you know, it's balanced, and balance is key to health. We need a little bit of a lot of things to keep these bodies working. And if we focus on just one thing, then we're thrown out of balance and, you know, we can have problems.
But it seems so contradictory because pork fat is kind of held up as the most evil of all bad fats. And yet what you discovered is that it may not be the best thing to eat 24/7, but it is certainly not a bad fat in the same way that it's been characterized by a lot of, well, various sort of communications that we receive around what is good and what is bad for us.
Yeah. And those communications are still evolving. Mm-hmm. Going back to the history of how saturated fats got their bad name, people are still disputing that. And I think in the long run, we are going to see the U.S. guidelines eventually changing to make it not such an evil player. And most people know that we need a balance of food. So we need to take the stigma off of fat and not feel so guilty about it.
And be a little bit more complex in our thinking and a bit more nuanced in terms of how we're balancing different parts of our nutrients.
Right. And just a little history on those guidelines. It started in the 50s with this one physician that decided that the saturated fats cause heart disease or are involved in it. He got the American Heart Association to buy into his theory. And so they in the 60s declared that saturated fats were bad for cardiovascular health. And then in the 80s, the U.S. government, when they did their first dietary guidelines for Americans, is what they call it, they put that in there in the 80s. And it still exists in there, saying that we should have less than 10%, but there's no good scientific evidence research that shows that. And people have gone back and looked at all this research, and there's big questions about how these studies were done and what they were looked at and whether they were cherry picked and all of that. So people are still disputing that and, let's say, fighting that. And so I wouldn't be surprised in the next decade or so if there's enough people to say, okay, we got to change this.
It's very compelling to see how much scientific research on food and nutrition and well-being and health change over the years and how much some things get pulled back on, even though they seem to be absolute and complete truth because they were labeled as science once upon a time. And so they had to be true.
Well, one of the things you really have to look at when you're looking at that science is who's funding the research. And the politics in this gets to be huge, is, you know, who's pushing the agenda and who's got the money to make donations or, you know, whatever needs to be done to get their voice heard. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a big, big political issue. And then you've got these, you know, these big organizations fighting to keep it once they've got it in place. And in the meantime, we've all got it in our heads that it's a bad thing.
Right, right. And it gets demonized, but also gets differently demonized in different places. I mean, you've lived now in a lot of different, many different countries, many different contexts. You've lived a few different lives, professionally and otherwise. How do you, if you do, see the ways that fat is appreciated or rejected in different cultures around the world? Are there differences that you've seen?
I would say yes. You know, it being in Italy really opened my eyes to that. And really, this is one of the reasons why I did the thesis, was my fellow American classmates, when we were doing those classes on cured meats, and my fellow classmates, we were all like, fat? Oh my God, you're going to make us eat all that? And it was, you know, it was this tense situation at times, like, should we really eat all that? You know, and it was so good. So it's this love guilt relationship that we've developed.
Yeah. And that's a problematic and complicated one, because it is so good to taste, not in massive quantities every single day of the week, but a beautifully cured piece of lardo on a crusty bit of polenta. Like, what could be more wonderful as it slowly drips down your fingers before you get it to your mouth?
Right. I had another experience. I was doing some organic farming volunteering in the Czech Republic. It's my heritage, family heritage. And I was living on a sustenance farm, that young couple with kids, just growing everything they could of their own. They made, you know, made all their own food and this amazing rye bread, and they would dip the, you know, their knife into the pig fat, the pig lard, to spread it on the bread. And my dad would tell me stories when he was growing up, you know, that's just what they did. That's part of the culture. And you know, they weren't cringing when they were doing it. They were enjoying it.
Yeah, totally. My mother and father described their honeymoon hitchhiking across Europe, where they would eat rye bread spread with goose fat and salt and garlic. And they would just sit in their little hostel room eating these fabulous sandwiches and thinking they were living the life of luxury.
I think the cultures that stick to their traditions are still doing that and honoring that. Trans fat industry, the margarines and all those things took over back there. And, you know, why did that happen? Why did Americans especially lose their traditional eating ways?
Well, it sort of feels like we've sucked the fat out of one thing and then dumped it into another thing. And now we've got like some super fatty foods on the one side and some super lean foods on the other side. And the same thing with, you know, sugars and all the other supposed evils of the world. Everything's become very extreme, either completely free of or overloaded with. And that integrity that you're talking about witnessing in the Czech Republic or in Italy is really about, well, it comes back to balance, I guess. But balance and maintaining a sense of history and integrity with the foods that make sense for you and your body.
Yeah.
Oh, Dev, it's so good to talk to you. It's so fun to share fatty experiences and memories. I'm wishing you all the best in everything that's about to happen for you. And thank you so much for being part of the conversation.
Thank you, David. It was my pleasure. It was great to see you again.
To learn more about Deb's work helping people identify and mitigate the lifestyle factors that contribute to chronic disease, go to her website at debolenick.com. That's debolenick.com. The link's also available in our show notes. Well, welcome to the first Stick This In Your Mouth Aperitivo edition. Hi, Maxime.
Hello, David.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
You ready to eat some fat?
Yes.
Do you like fat?
I do like fat.
What is it about fat that you like?
I mean, fat is as you have told me in the past, fast, it helps flavor carry through, so that's one of the reasons why I like fat.
Yeah, well, yeah, fat is like basically water, alcohol, and fat are the three main solvents in which flavors and aromas are dissolved in food. And so fat dissolves some things that, say, water doesn't. And that's why things that are fatty often taste a lot better.
There you go.
What kind of fat things do you like to eat?
Potato chips.
Of course. So has there ever been a time in your life that you were averse to eating fat?
Not necessarily fatty food, but when I was a kid, I remember taking off the fat of like slices of ham. And it's more of a texture thing than a taste thing, because once again, it's a little gelatinous.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of people avoid fat. There are a lot of low-fat foods. There's a lot of other stuff that we do to not ingest fat. And that's partly because the food industry, the diet industry tells us to do that. But do you have any kind of negative feelings about eating fat? When you look at something that's really fatty and unctuous and, you know, potentially delicious, but is there any kind of guilt that comes along with
that?
Well,
there used to be a moment in my life where I was running away from fat because I used to be a bigger person and I was on a diet at one point. So I was just trying to be eating low-fat foods and as little fat as possible.
I remember myself, I went on the Scarsdale diet with my mother I was, you know, 13 or something like this, really should not have been going on a diet. And of course, after a week, we quit because it was so stupid and we were both starving all the time because we were eating nothing that filled us up, including fat, which also increases satiety. It makes you feel full. So it's good to eat fat because it tells your body you're full.
I was on a similar diet as well.
Well, let's just be happy that you're not on that diet anymore and potato chips are still part of your life.
Yes, very much so.
Okay, so we're going to try a couple of different fatty things right now. A plant-based fat, if you will. We've got some delicious little canapés with avocado and mayonnaise and sriracha on them on rice crackers. And we've got some whipped lardo, courtesy of our friend Nick, who made it and I bought it from. And we're going to try that on some crackers.
Before we eat the lardo, can mm-hmm. you tell me what is lardo?
Sure. Well, you can see it's in this little mason jar, and it sort of looks like creamy butter or something like that. But lardo is back fat from a pig. It's lard that is cured, salted, and aged in Italy. But I think there are a few other countries that make lardo, but it's one of the many forms of charcuterie that salumi, in fact, that Italy produces. And it's really cool because it's these sheets of fat that are salted and seasoned with different herbs. And then in certain parts of Italy, it's then put in giant marble coffers, and that's how it ages. And then it's taken out, sliced very thinly, like prosciutto, and served like prosciutto, either on a charcuterie plate or I had once on cubes of grilled polenta, and the lardo started to melt. It was so good. So we're just going to try it on a piece of toast, on a crouton. Shall I serve you some?
Yes, please.
Okay. So this is whipped lardo. So Nick cured the lard, and then mixed it with grappa and fennel seeds and chili. What do you think? Crunchy.
Sorry for the long pause.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tasty.
That's good. Wow.
It's very tasty. It's not at all what I was expecting.
No. What were you thinking? What were you thinking it would be?
Well,
like,
you know, knowing that it's going to be fat and it's going to be whipped, I was expecting, I don't know, I didn't, because it's a very delicate taste. It's not super pronounced, but at the same time, very unctuous. It's not oily so much.
It's not greasy at all, really. It's fatty, but not greasy.
And the flavoring is also very interesting. It's quite delicate, but it's...
Like when I was tasting it, it's sort of like butter, but with a little bit of meatiness or texture. It's not quite fibrous, but there's a little... You
know, it's super interesting. Yeah. It's something that I've not really eaten before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extra delicious, but it's very refined. It's a very simple taste. But at the same time, you know that you're eating something unusual.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it is. Okay, let's try the plant-based fat, avocado. Avocados are a nice fatty fruit, delicious, problematic in terms of their agriculture because they use a lot of water and transport and labor. And anyway, but they are delicious. Sad to say, wonderful things often come with sad stories. And this one has a little bit of mayonnaise on it just to smooth out the fattiness.
Hike up the fat content.
It is good.
Such a pleasant feeling.
Well, it's interesting because after having just eaten the lardo, the avocado has a similar, it's a bit waterier, but it's got a kind of similar smoothness and fibrousness in a very pleasant way.
Yes, absolutely. But it also has this fruity flavor, but it's also very delicate tasting. I love avocado so much because it marries so well with other flavors and carries them.
Speaking of interesting flavors that go with avocado, when I was in Timor-Leste once, I had what they called an avocado juice. It turns out it was just pure avocado blended with some water to make it a little bit drinkable. And then it was served with a spiral of chocolate syrup, like Hershey's chocolate syrup.
Wow.
And it was one of the best things I've ever had. Chocolate and avocado go incredibly well together. And of course, it makes sort of sense when you think of it as a fruit, but it makes less sense when you think of it as a vegetable. So avocados are sometimes called good fat sources versus the, in quotes, bad fat of animal fat. Do you have any feelings about that, kind of calling one fat good and one fat bad?
I think we have to be mindful of our eating habits. But I think, once again, for me, it's always everything in moderation.
All right. So maybe we'll have something other for dinner tonight, not just lardo and avocado.
But let's finish the aperitivo, though.
Yes. Okay. Santé.
Santé.
You know, I remember a TV advertisement for Pam cooking spray from probably the 1980s. It extolled the virtues of using the product because it added less fat to the dish you'd be cooking with it. The ad included a shot of a lump of butter being dropped into the pan, sizzling away juicily, and then another of a thick, almost kind of sinuous stream of oil going bloop, bloop, bloop into the same pan. Both shots, I think, were meant to make butter and oil seem disgusting and heavy and bad for our health, just bad overall. Pam, which was light and airy and silent, was the response, and obviously the product they were trying to get us to buy. This is probably roughly the same time that my mother and I went on that awful diet I mentioned. It was a period in my life when I felt pretty ashamed of my adolescent body, having been no doubt influenced by all the diet products in the stores, by my gym teachers, and by the waves of media and marketing I was bathing in at the time. Shame was pretty much the only response available. The Pam ad really stuck with me all these decades, and it exemplifies the ways in which fat was and still is made visually unappealing. I still have a complex relationship with fat and fatness, and that's going to be a lifelong journey for me. And it's one, I think, that certainly many of us are on or have been on. But while we walk it, maybe, as Virgie and Jenna and Deb have suggested, we can start to build up a new set of conversations and perceptions around fat. Ones that aren't so damaging and traumatic to us and to our kids and to their kids, and ones that aren't so profitable to those who want to exploit our inner fat phobia. The last unctuous bite for this episode is the Making a Meal of It food questionnaire, with our first respondent coming from the world of science. John Schreiner retired as chief of medical physics at the Cancer Center of Southeastern Ontario in 2019, and he's now a professor emeritus of oncology and physics, engineering physics, and astronomy at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Sharing food and gifts of food is a strong tradition in his family, he says, and as we recorded his questionnaire responses, John described himself as sociable, artistic, and faithful. John, what is your idea of a perfect food?
A deep, flavorful stew or goulash or a biryani.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
Street food in some rougher settings, especially when you're walking by and it smells and looks so good.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Slow-cooked.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Rushed.
Which food person do you most admire?
Jacques Pepin.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Home delivery takeout.
For what do you hunger?
Every now and then, I do really crave beans.
What do you consider to be an overrated food or food context?
Trendy, expensive restaurants.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
When offered a second helping of turnip.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
That some tables you can't get enough friends around.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
A nice firm texture with some tartness.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
A cut that is tender and juicy and not too lean.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Salt and sometimes garlic.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
Gardens that are ready to harvest, especially with tomatoes.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
I wish I knew how to bake, and I wish I had the patience for it.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
Make all food healthy.
Where and or when would you most like to dine?
There's a restaurant in Vienna that I would love to go back to eat a chanterelle mushroom dish that I didn't order a few years back. My wife ordered it, and I just watched the whole time.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
A slow cooker, just above my coffee maker.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Montreal smoked meat.
What is your favorite aroma?
Fresh ground coffee.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
Baking implements and baking cookbooks.
What do you most value in your friends' food?
The friends.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
Again, Jacques Pepin. And Glenn Powell from Glenn and Friends.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
Canadian, because it's so diverse from all corners of the world, a true blessing.
What is your most powerful sense?
Smell.
What would you eat as your second to last meal?
A good barbecue brisket or a smoked meat platter?
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
He set a welcoming table.
What question would you either add to this questionnaire or like to ask me?
What particular mashup of ethnic foods from different countries has made a memorable meal for you?
So that concludes this episode of Making a Meal of It. Great gobs of gratitude go out to Jennifer Brady, Virgie Tovar, Deb Olenek, Maxime Giroux, and John Schreiner. Thank you also to the pollinators and wetlands creatures that contribute their voices and bodies to our ecosystems, and to all the less visible yet absolutely irreplaceable actors in our systems of food and food culture. For news and show notes, check out makingamealofit.com or follow us at Making a Meal Podcast on most social media platforms. As usual, like, rate, and subscribe, please, wherever you listen. Next week, we're looking at food systems in conflict, both from an art and environment angle, as well as perspectives on reconciliation and understanding between indigenous and settler colonial worldviews. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as I have recently learned to say in Swahili, Karibu Chakula.